Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In 2017, today's guest, Richard Rothstein, wrote the book, The Color of Law, A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America. It details how laws and policy decisions promoted discriminatory patterns. For example, Richmond, Milpitas, and Palo Alto all had subdivisions where it was illegal for African Americans to own a home. Many of the Bay Area's segregated low-income neighborhoods can be traced directly back to discriminatory housing policies, either created or enforced by local, state, and federal authorities. The evidence Richard Rothstein cited shows that those policies in the 20th century ensured that Black and white people could not live near each other. The Color of Law was a ground almost a million copies. Many readers of the book and many who attended Richard Rothstein's talks asked, well, what can we do about this now? Well, Richard Rothstein is not a housing or a policy expert. In order to answer that question, he recruited someone with the expertise that he lacked, his daughter, Leah Rothstein. She's a land use policy consultant, affordable housing development advisor, and community and union organizer. Richard and Leah Rothstein worked on a new book together to answer that question, What Can We Do Now? The book is called Just Action, How to Challenge Segregation Enacted Under. They write, residential segregation underlies our most serious social problems, including health inequity, police violence, political polarization, and wealth gaps. The Rothsteins argue that the key to ending housing segregation is a reinvigorated civil rights movement, one that begins locally and advocates for improved resources, zoning reform, effective control of urban gentrification, and the stemming of white flight. And we're happy to have the Rothsteins with us today to talk about these strategies. Richard Rothstein is a distinguished fellow of the Economic Policy Institute and a senior fellow at the Thurgood Marshall Institute of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. Hi, Richard. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Thank you.
Great to have you. Leah Rothstein is a housing policy consultant in the Bay Area. She's been a consultant to nonprofit housing developers, cities and counties, redevelopment agencies, and private firms on community development and affordable housing policy, practice, and finance. Hi, Leah. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Well, it's great to have both of you. So, Richard, I want to start off with you. You were on our show in 2018 talking about The Color of Law. In fact, I think we had you on twice because we got such an incredible response to that show. In the author's notes in the new book, you write about that experience. So can you tell us just what it was like to do so many interviews? And then people would come up to you after the talks you gave and say, well, what can we do about this now?
Well, it was an incredible experience. People said, why didn't I learn this in high school? How could I have not known this history? And of course, it was all out in the open. There was nothing secret about it. The Color of Law subtitle was A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America. It wasn't a hidden history. People knew, for example, that the public housing projects that were in their communities, or which many of them, both Black and whites, lived, were segregated, separate projects for whites, separate projects for African Americans. People knew that when they got an FHA mortgage, they were frequently required to have a clause in their deed prohibiting resale of homes to African Americans, and they lived in communities that were financed by the FHA and VA on a segregated basis, prohibiting African Americans from living there. So they were shocked that they didn't know this history that was out in front of them. But they didn't know what to do about it, as you said in your introduction. And Leah and I believed that at this point, there is no political will in this country to enact national policies to redress the segregation that underlies all of those social problems that you mentioned, economic problems that you mentioned. But once you have a segregated society with two groups of people living separately from each other, based solely on their race, there's local policy and programs and practices that reinforce and expand it. And what we do in Just Action is we document the many, many things at a local level that people who get engaged in reform can enact and change and press for change to begin the process of desegregating the society. So it starts locally. It has to start locally. Victories initially may be small, but they'll build on each other. And if people are engaged, we can actually make real change at a local level. Finally, let me say it's not only the color of law that got people engaged in this, as you know, as all your listeners know, 20 million Americans participated in the Black Lives Matter demonstrations in 2020. And then when the demonstrations were over and those people who participated were white and black, suburban and urban, low income and middle income, when the demonstrations were over, they went home, they put Black Lives Matter signs on their lawns or in their windows and did nothing further. And Leah and I believe that the reason they did nothing further was that they didn't know what to do and nobody asked them to do anything. And so that's the reason why we wrote Just Action, because there is so much that people can do to make this a more decent, more egalitarian society.
And Leah, in the book, you write that after you read The Color of Law in 2017, you asked your dad, what can we do about it now? And he said, I don't know. It's going to be up to your generation to figure this out, not mine. So as a housing policy analyst, can you talk about what your reaction was when you had conversations with your dad about the book and when you read the book?
Yeah, well, you're right. I was one of the people who read The Color of Law and listened to his lectures and was so shocked that I didn't know that history that was so clearly laid out in The Color of Law, and also struck by, you know, the next question is, what do we do now that we are reckoning with this true history? How can we change it? And as you said, I've worked in housing policy, community development policy as an organizer, and I didn't know what to do. The segregation of our country, it feels so overwhelming, intractable, persistent. It feels like, you know, just the water we swim in, it feels impossible to change, even in working on policy around these issues and in organizing in communities. So I didn't know what the way forward was until we started talking about it and actually listing out all of the local policies that can have an impact on challenging and redressing segregation. And I realized, wow, there actually is a lot that we can do. It's actually a lot more hopeful than I started feeling, you know, than how I felt at the start of writing this book. And now I'm traveling around the country talking about it, and I feel even more hopeful. There's people, there's groups all around the country in all types of communities taking on these issues and reckoning with this history and trying to figure out what to do about it and finding ways to have an impact.
Leah, given that you are a housing policy consultant, it sounds like you've done a lot of work with many, many different facets of the housing industry, from nonprofits to private groups. How did you go about doing the research to figure out what people can actually do about housing segregation?
Yeah, well, there's very little in Just Action that is our original ideas. You know, these ideas are out there. They're just spread around. There's academics and experts that work on one issue and get all into the weeds about them. And there isn't really a place that compiles all of the many policies and programs we can adopt locally to have an impact on this issue. So that's what we were attempting to do. So we, just from my experience, my dad's experience, our knowledge, we listed out what we knew that local policies that could have an impact on segregation, and started there and started researching what the academics were saying, researching what local groups were doing. We did a lot of interviews and talking to people all around the country, because for each strategy or policy or program that we profile in the book, we also give an example of a community that successfully implemented that strategy. And so we interviewed a lot of groups around the country working on these issues that would then lead us to another issue. And so it just sort of unfolded in that way.
Richard, what was the process like for you, given that your last book got so much attention, to think that it sold almost 1 million copies because so many people are interested in this issue? What was it like for you to really focus on solutions to these problems?
Well, I did know something about local policy, not as much as Leah. And of course, I love to do research. And so I became immersed in many of these issues that I had no idea before about how they worked. I'll give you one quick example, something I had no knowledge about before. I began to look into local property tax assessments, the things that tax assessors do. And I discovered in the course of my research that throughout the country, assessments are discriminatory in effect, not in intent. Tax assessment systems aren't intended to be discriminatory, but on average, African Americans pay property taxes at a higher rate relative to the value of their homes than whites do. There are many reasons for this. One of them is that most tax assessors in almost all of the country don't do a physical reassessment of property every year. What they do is they do one maybe once every 10 years, and then they simply adjust it for inflation. And in that intervening time, properties in white neighborhoods tend to appreciate in value faster than properties in black neighborhoods do. So over time, the assessments of homes in white neighborhoods fall farther and farther below the real market value of their homes than the assessments of homes in black neighborhoods do. And so African Americans wind up paying property taxes at a higher rate than whites. Well, this is a purely local issue. The federal government has absolutely nothing to do with property tax assessments. And all it takes is an organized movement of people at a local level, whites and blacks joining together to press for reform in how the property tax assessment system works, or finding alternative ways of funding our schools and libraries and fire departments. So that's an example of something that I discovered in the course of this research I had no idea about. When we talk about just action, most people we talk to have no idea about this before we describe it to them. And it's something that people who are engaged in their local communities can actually organize together to change. And it would make a big, big difference in the wealth gap that we have and how much money people can save if they're not overpaying in their property taxes, African Americans in particular. So that's an example of something I discovered in the course of my research on this. There were many, many others that both Leah and I uncovered in the course of doing this, just like that one.
Well, and like that one, you also, like you say, since you traveled around the world, the country, and looked at examples to enact change on this issue, you write that in Cook County, Illinois, assessments have had a racially discriminatory effect for at least 50 years. Fritz Kagi, its assessor, has created a webpage where homeowners can appeal their assessments without a lawyer's assistant, but it's too soon to know whether this will have any significant benefit for African American taxpayers. So that's just one example of where people are trying to remedy this problem, Richard.
Well, but this can't be done with individuals filing appeals. This is a systematic issue, a systematic injustice and discriminatory system. Assessor Kagi in Chicago, and that's the example we use in the book, but I want to emphasize this is systematic nationwide. It's not only a Chicago issue. He admits that his system he's administering is discriminatory, but he has no solutions for fixing it. And of course, there's no public pressure for him to fix it. What Just Action does is it explains how there can be public pressure to get assessors like Fritz Kagi, as well as those around the country, to begin to take seriously the fact that they're operating a system that they understand themselves is discriminatory.
Let's go back to what you said about Black Lives Matter, because we did obviously so many shows about that, and there were uprisings in areas of California that I have never even heard of. I mean, we're white areas. So this was a mass mobilization. Leah, can you talk about what your thoughts are in terms of what came out of this around housing segregation? And as you write in the book, we need a new civil rights movement to truly address this. So, given that you've spent so much time thinking about these issues, what have you come up with when you look back at that massive uprising?
Well, I think that there's that uprising tells us that there's appetite for change. We want to see a more racially egalitarian society. We see the impacts it has on all of us that we have not yet made bigger strides in achieving that. But we, not much has come out of that movement in terms of housing segregation. And, you know, I think, like my dad said, it's because we don't know what to do. It's not easy. You know, the Fair Housing Act was passed in 1968. It outlawed the discrimination by race in the sale and rental of housing, but housing segregation has not changed much since then. The home ownership gap between blacks and whites has gotten worse. And that's because when you change a law like that, when you outlaw discrimination, it doesn't change the landscape of the communities we live in. It doesn't address the disparities that exist because of past government policies, like the racial wealth gap that we have, due in large part to the government policies that subsidize whites into home ownership when home ownership was affordable and explicitly prohibited African Americans from doing the same. So we need a movement that takes on this issue. It's not just going to change by itself. You know, we've had decades of waiting for it to change, and it hasn't. And so we need to take this on in our own communities and build this activated civil rights movement that can take on housing segregation. And I think The Color of Law helped us realize how we got here, that it wasn't an accident. It wasn't just a natural occurrence that our country is racially segregated. And we're more aware of the implications and the consequences of that, that we have, you know, killings of African Americans by police officers all over the country. We have health disparities in life expectancies between blacks and whites all over the country. These are serious consequences to the segregation of our neighborhoods. And if we're serious about creating a more equal and just society, we have to take on this issue. And to do that, we need to build this movement locally. And, you know, we hope that this book shows that it's possible to do that.
Well, and just to share a few more facts that are in the book, African American home ownership rates are no better today than they were 50 years ago. More low-income African Americans live in neighborhoods with highly concentrated poverty than 50 years ago, largely because middle-class African Americans have had more opportunities to leave. Although African Americans are now found in almost all executive suites, there are almost none at the top. Only 5 CEOs in the Fortune 500 are black. And some things have gotten much worse, in particular, the mass incarceration of African Americans. Today, 1 in 81 are imprisoned, up from 1 in 271 in 1970. A black man in his 20s now has a 1 in 3 chance of being confined to prison at some time in his life. And of course, this has a devastating impact on black families and communities. Today, we are speaking with Richard Rothstein and Leah Rothstein about their new book, Just Action, How to Challenge Segregation Enacted Under the Color of Law. And if you'd like to join us, if you have any questions about housing segregation and solutions, what are your thoughts about what came out of the Black Lives Matter movement? If you were part of that movement or part of movements today, is housing segregation a key part of your activism? And then also, what about life in your neighborhood? Is your neighborhood segregated? Was it when you grew up? How has that affected you and then policies in your wider community? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Let's talk about the result of segregated communities that are in so many of our lives. I mean, it's not hard to find so many segregated communities in the Bay Area. And as you write, segregated communities underlie some of our most serious social problems, including health inequity, police violence, political polarization, and wealth gaps. Can you talk more about this, Richard?
Well, sure. The wealth gap is directly attributable to the policies, unconstitutional, unlawful policies of the federal government enacted in the 20th century. In The Color of Law, you may recall, the example I use is Levittown, east of New York City, although it's true, as you mentioned in your introduction, and in places here in California, Daly City, Milpitas, Richmond. The federal government issued mortgages and guaranteed loans to developers like Leavitt, to build massive suburban developments at a time when we weren't a suburban country. Both blacks and whites were living in urban areas because we were a manufacturing economy and factories needed to be located near deepwater ports and railroad terminals to get their parts and ship their final products. And so both black and white factory workers, as well as the workers at the banks and the insurance companies and other institutions that service those factories, all were located in relatively close in downtown areas. The federal government began a program to move the entire white population out of urban areas into single family homes in all white suburbs. This was not the action of rogue bureaucrats working for federal housing agencies. It was written out in federal policy manuals that you couldn't guarantee a bank loan. The federal government couldn't guarantee a bank loan to a developer who was going to sell homes to African Americans. Well, the people who bought those homes, the whites, in places like Levittown or Daly City or in Long Beach Lakewood or any of these developments, suburban developments all over the country, but they weren't rich people. They were working class whites. They were returning war veterans. The homes were inexpensive. They cost at the time, in today's money, about $100,000. African Americans who had jobs in the post-war boom, and most of them did, could have afforded those homes almost just as easily as whites. But the whites who moved into those homes, the factory workers who moved into those homes, gained over the next couple of generations wealth from the appreciation and the value of those homes. They didn't expect it to happen. They were just looking for a place to live. We had a housing shortage at that time. But they got these very modest single-family homes. The homes appreciated in value, and they used the equity that they gained to send their children to college, to take care of temporary emergencies, maybe unemployment, to subsidize their retirements, and to bequeath wealth to their children and grandchildren, who then had down payments for their own homes. Well, those homes in suburbs all over the country today, both in California, New York, and everywhere in between, no longer sell for $100,000. They sell for $200,000, $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 in California, $1 million or more. As Leah mentioned, in 1968, we passed the Fair Housing Act. It said, in effect, okay, African Americans, you're no longer prohibited from moving into these suburbs. Go ahead. But of course, they're unaffordable today to people whose families could have afforded them 50, 60 years ago when they were excluded. So this wealth gap that was created, African-American incomes today are about 60%, 60% of white incomes. You'd expect that the wealth gap would be similar. People can save the same amount of money from the same incomes. But in reality, although African-American incomes are 60% of white incomes, African-American wealth is only 5% of white wealth. And that enormous disparity, which creates the segregation that we have today, is entirely attributable to unconstitutional and illegal federal government policy. Well, you can't do anything to desegregate the society without dealing with the fact that African Americans, because of lack of wealth, are still disproportionately located in close-in suburbs or downtown urban areas, which are less well-resourced than whites. African-American, for example, middle-class families who have same incomes as white middle-class families live in neighborhoods with much higher poverty rates than whites do. That means their children go to much less well-resourced schools, even though their family incomes might be the same as white incomes. So the wealth gap is a determinant to some extent of the segregation that we have today, and we've got to find ways to subsidize African-American movement into communities that are now otherwise unaffordable to them, but that would have been affordable to them and that would be affordable to them if they had been permitted to inherit the kind of wealth from the appreciation of modest homes that whites were subsidized to do.
We're going to take a quick break. Today, we're speaking with Richard and Leah Rothstein, author of the new book, Just Action, How to Challenge Segregation Enacted Under the Color of Law. Richard Rothstein is a distinguished fellow of the Economic Policy Institute and senior fellow at the Thurgood Marshall Institute of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. Leah Rothstein is a housing policy consultant in the San Francisco Bay Area. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on tomorrow's media roundtable, we'll discuss coverage of President Biden's State of the Union address. He's expected to call for an expansion of the housing supply, some show, and renew his call to tax the rich and corporations. We will see what he says about Israel and the worsening humanitarian crisis in Gaza. Palestinian health officials report that at least 20 people have died from malnutrition and dehydration. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email yourcall@kalw.org. And if you'd like to join today's conversation with Richard Rothstein and Leo Rothstein, author of the new book, Just Action, How to Challenge Segregation Enacted Under the Color of Law, we'd love to hear from you. If you have a personal story to share about the neighborhood you grew up in or where you live today, is it segregated? If you are Black, your grandparents, what housing opportunities did they have? Your parents? If you have any personal stories about how you've been affected by housing segregation, we would love to hear from you. And if you work on these issues, what are your thoughts on solutions? 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Richard and Lee, residential segregation underlies our most serious social problems. They say the key to ending housing segregation is a reinvigorated civil rights movement, one that begins locally and advocates for improved resources, zoning reform, and the stemming of white flight. Leah, before we went to break, we were talking about segregation. And in your first chapter, You Should Just Do It, Forming Biracial Committees May Be Difficult But Not Impossible, you write that our residential and social segregation is now so extreme that many, even those who understand its harm and want to remedy it, have few personal friendships outside their own racial groups. Whites and Blacks now frequently interact in workplaces and government offices, even in parent-teacher associations in desegregated schools, but not as often in places where they engage in conversations that go beyond the business they may be conducting. And you cite a survey from 2022 that found 2/3 of white adults had not discussed a single important matter with a non-white person in the previous 6 months. Leah, can you talk more about that?
Yeah, sure. Sorry, I lost you for a second. It's true. Both Blacks and whites, we also cite a survey that shows that both Blacks and whites want to have more social contacts, more friendships with people of other races. But as we've been talking about, we live in segregated communities all over the country. So going about our regular business of the day in our neighborhoods, going to the grocery store, the park, dropping our kids off at school, we tend to meet and see people who look like us. And so if we're to build an effective, reactivated civil rights movement to take on these issues, we argue that we need to start by building biracial groups and committees that have leadership that's both Black and white, membership that's biracial, multi-ethnic. And we have to take some intentional steps to build those relationships, to create those groups, because it's not just happening naturally because of the nature of the communities we live in. So we give some examples in the book about communities that have done this to show that it's not impossible. One example we write about is from Winston-Salem, North Carolina, where there were six congregations of a Presbyterian church, six Presbyterian congregations around the city, three in the white side of town, three in the African-American side of town, you know, same race congregations. They had no contact with each other. And then this was around the time of the Rodney King riots in Los Angeles, and other racial issues in their city were happening. And so the pastors of these congregations decided they wanted to build a biracial dialogue, start a dialogue with people of different races in their community to address the issues that they were facing. They started a group. They called it the Presbyterian Interracial Dialogue. It had to have equal representation of Blacks and whites from the different congregations. It had to maintain that equal representation. So if someone, you know, wanted off of this group, they had to be replaced by someone of the same race. It went on for years, and they built relationships by meeting regularly and then meeting outside of the group meetings. And then this group went on to advocate for changes in their community. They advocated and won a civilian police review board. And they advocated that the local school district adopt an African-American history curriculum, and they won that as well. And then they went on to build some Habitat for Humanity homes in their city. So this was an example of it might take some intentional efforts to bring people of different races together in our communities, but it's possible to do that. And then it can be very effective in then building a group that can advocate for change.
As you write, these pastors encouraged participants to meet socially between meetings, but few at first felt comfortable doing so. Most had never been to an other race home or had an other race friendship. I mean, Leah, I have to say, when I first read this section of the book, it was kind of surreal to read something like this in 2024. But this is where we are. And I mean, it's important. Some people out there might be thinking, okay, this is not my experience at all. But this is definitely the experience of so many people. And it's important to highlight. The other example that stood out for me was Tonika Johnson, an African-American resident of Inglewood, a mostly Black neighborhood on Chicago's segregated South Side, where median income is less than half the city's. Chicago's Black population is concentrated in the South and the West Side, while whites are concentrated in the North. So this is a fascinating example also. Can you tell us more about Tonika Johnson and what you found?
Yeah, I'd love to. This is a great story. So Tonika Johnson is an artist, an activist artist. She's a photographer. She wanted to create a project that addressed the segregation of Chicago, just what you described. And she took the unique layout of Chicago, which is laid out in a perfect grid so that the streets have a north side and a south side and the same house numbers on the street. The north side of Chicago is all mostly white, the south side mostly African American. She took the map of Chicago and folded it in half so that the homes with the same house numbers on the north and south side of the same street sat perfectly on top of each other. And she called those homes map twins. And she photographed the homes to show that these homes are not all that different in construction or style, but the context they exist in is very different because of the segregation of the city. So she created a photographic exhibit first, and then she introduced herself to the residents of the homes, told them about her project, asked them if they wanted to meet their map twin. And just like you said, these were people, many of them had lived in Chicago their whole lives and had never been to the other side of town or known somebody from the other side of town. So many of them were excited to participate in this project. They met their map twins. They toured the other neighborhood and took their map twin on a tour of their neighborhood. They started to develop relationships and learn that they're not that different. They had similar hopes and dreams, but their communities were very different. They lived in very differently resourced communities. So they started to get curious about why that is. And then they went on to build larger groups. They called them block twins. And whole blocks would get together from Englewood and from the white side of town. And they did some neighborhood beautification efforts. They did some mutual support activities during the pandemic. And this is, you know, this was an art project. So the next step would be a community organizer going to these block twin groups and getting them activated to figure out what they could do in Chicago to affect some of the causes and consequences of the segregation of their city. Mm-hmm. And it's a great story. It's, you know, sort of a unique kind of gimmick to fold the map in half, but you don't need a perfectly laid out grid of a city to do something like this. Since the book came out, I've written about a group in San Diego County that does a similar thing with different communities in San Diego where they call it the Sister City Project. So often, you know, cities have a sister city in another country that they provide support to. And why not have it in our own community, in our own region, when our communities, our neighborhoods are so differently resourced and so polarized and separated from each other? So this group brings people from all Black communities in San Diego County and all white communities. They bring them together to learn together and provide some mutual support. So it's possible to do no matter what the map of your city looks like. It just takes these intentional efforts, and they can be hugely rewarding personally and then also on a larger community level.
I love this, Leah. I would love to have some of these people on the show to talk about what the experience was like for them. Because as you say, Leah, there is so much we can do at the local level. And sometimes I feel like people are so focused on the national, for obvious reasons, 24/7 coverage of Trump, what is happening with this country. Now we're in an election year. It's going to be 24/7 coverage. We just did many shows about the Senate race in California. And yet local issues are so important. And sadly, voter turnout on Tuesday was so incredibly low. It almost feels like media need to do a better job of talking about the importance of what is possible at the local level.
Yeah, I think that could help. I think you're right. We have this sort of bombardment of what's happening on the national level, and it feels impossible to affect any change on that. But there is so much happening on the local level, not only so much that we can do, but so much that is happening in communities all across the country. I would love to hear more about that on a regular basis. I think it provides hope, it provides a way forward, and gives us some agency back in this question of, you know, when we think segregation only happened by accident, it can only unhappen by accident. But when we can see people like us in communities like ours who are making changes in their local government, their local policies and programs, and we can see that I can do the same thing in my community, and we can start to make those changes locally that can then build to a national movement. But we really have to start locally, and that's where we can affect change.
Right. We have a caller who didn't want to stay to come on the air who said, isn't poverty another reason for discrimination? Poor whites get segregated from rich whites. Also, this country is just not committed to building quality housing for poor people. Richard, do you want to respond to that first?
Well, he's certain that, or he or she, this caller, was certainly correct about this, but they're not equivalent. Poor whites, for example, tend to live dispersed throughout middle-class white communities, except for perhaps Appalachia. You don't find low-income neighborhoods filled with poor whites the way you find low-income neighborhoods filled with poor African-Americans. One of the reasons is that white poverty tends to be more episodic. People move in and out of poverty at lower wages. They lose a job. Black poverty, because of the history of segregation that we've talked about earlier, tends to be permanent, multi-generational. And so you have neighborhoods of concentrated poverty where African Americans live that whites don't. Now, it's true we have an enormous housing shortage in this country, and we're doing very little to redress it. But the housing shortage is not just for poor people. The housing shortage is also for middle-income, middle-class families. You know, we have subsidy programs for poor people, and we build affordable housing, what we call affordable housing for them. Not enough, but we build some. And then there are people who can afford market rate housing in today's ridiculous housing market. But the people in between those two who can't afford market rate housing, but who earn too much to be able to afford what we call affordable housing, that is subsidized housing, they're stuck. And they wind up not having adequate housing or moving far away from their jobs in order to find it. One of the things we talk about in Just Action is the importance of mixed income housing that doesn't just mix the poorest and the richest people, but has a full range of incomes. We describe a program in a project in Massachusetts. Massachusetts has a subsidy, its own state subsidy, not a federal subsidy, for missing middle housing, for middle income housing, working class housing, people who have jobs but can't afford housing in the crazy housing market that we have today. We profile one project in a suburb of Boston where 15% of the units are set aside for the lowest income families with Section 8 vouchers provided by the federal government. One-fifth of the units are set aside for market rate, people who can afford to pay full market rate for their units. And the middle are subsidized much more mildly than the low-income units by the state of Massachusetts for middle-income housing. We profile this project. All of the units are identical. There's no discrimination based on what kind of unit you have. In fact, if somebody in a Section 8 unit gets a better job and is no longer eligible for the deep subsidy, their unit is reclassified as a middle-income unit, and the next middle-income unit that becomes available is rented to a Section 8 tenant. All the units are identical. And I interviewed a number of people in this project. None of them had any idea which kind of unit their neighbors were in. It was racially as well as economically mixed. That's something that is a local program. It's not a federal program. federal government doesn't have a subsidy for middle-income families, but that can be done locally, and it can be done locally if people, as Leah keeps saying, organize to press for it.
Leah, I also appreciated that you and your dad focused on ugly stereotypes in type. For moderate income housing is not the only reason that so many housing advocates seem interested only in, quote, affordable units for the poor. Another explanation is that too many whites, including some housing experts, retain the stereotype that Black and poor are almost the same thing. Yet only 1/6 of African Americans are poor. That is more than triple the white rate, but still only a small share of Black people. 1 in 8 African-American workers are private sector business managers. Another 1/5 are professionals. Can you talk about why it was important to include this information?
Yeah, well, I think it's, you know, it's common when we hear the term affordable housing that it applies just to the housing that's affordable to the very lowest income amongst us. So subsidized low-income housing that is termed, quote-unquote, affordable housing. But as my dad just explained, there isn't housing affordable to middle-income families either, and that's where most African-Americans fall in that middle-income category. So if we're concerned with redressing segregation and providing housing opportunities for African-Americans in well-resourced neighborhoods, we need to be talking about a broader definition of affordable housing. So housing that's affordable to those that make too much to qualify for subsidized low-income housing and too little to afford market-rate housing in these communities. We need to expand that understanding of what affordable housing is. And I'll just add that, you know, we're in an affordable housing crisis all across the country. We have a lack of housing of all types in all types of communities. And we have an opportunity as we're starting to address this locally all across the country and some national conversations on how to address the housing supply problem. We have an opportunity to not forget about housing segregation and how we address this housing affordability crisis. These are overlapping problems. You know, one of the reasons why we're in a housing affordability crisis and don't have enough housing for anybody is because of our desire to create and maintain segregated communities has limited our community's ability to build enough housing. So here we are, there's not enough housing for everybody. Our communities are experiencing record numbers of unhoused residents. And as we address those problems, we need to think about how those solutions will impact the segregation of our communities. We have to ensure that we're building low-income housing in higher opportunity or better well-resourced communities. And we have to ensure that we're building housing that's affordable to middle-income families, particularly African-American families in communities that they've historically been excluded from.
Today, we're speaking with Richard and Leah Rothstein, authors of Just Action, How to Challenge Segregation Enacted Under the Color of Law. We have a couple of emails from listeners. Zipporah writes, California's Prop 13, passed in 1978, has limited property taxes for homeowners for decades. Has it also exacerbated the discrimination suffered by non-white homeowners? Richard, do you want to take that?
Well, Prop 13's main, I think, negative effect is starving the public sector, which, of course, was its intent. It was proposed by people who are opposed to public programs, to school funding that would be adequate, and to other resources. So Prop 13's main impact is it prohibits or denies the resources that cities need to provide the kinds of support that would be needed to redress the segregation in the ways that we've talked about. So reforming Prop 13 is certainly a critical ambition in the state of California. We actually have a suggestion in Just Action of a way that it could be reformed that would, I think, be less controversial than the present reforms that are being discussed. Prop 13 could preserve homeowners' property taxes and at the rate that they were paying, or adjusted for inflation, of course, since they purchased the home. But when they eventually sell the home, and in California, people sell homes today at hundreds of thousands of dollars more than they paid for them. At the point when they sell their home, the lost taxes that they would have otherwise paid at that point get returned to the public treasury. So you both protect people from being forced out of their homes because of higher property taxes, but at the same time, you reimburse the treasury at a time when they can afford it for the lost income, and that would enable California to do much more to address the kinds of problems we've been discussing. Again, that's a purely local reform, well, in this case, statewide reform, but it's nothing the federal government has anything to do with.
Well, let's hear from another caller. Let's go to Barbara. Hi, Barbara. Welcome to the show. Hi, Barbara. Is Barbara there? All right. Well, sorry about that, Barbara. You can give us a call back. Can we spend, we have about 8 minutes left. Can we talk about your section about the Supreme Court? Because this is very important. You write, timid deference to the Supreme Court blocks racial equality. You point to a number of court decisions that have upheld or maintained segregation. And you write that there's little doubt that today the court would strike down new public and private programs that redress the legacies of slavery and Jim Crow by taking race-targeted housing opportunities for Black households. You say that that is no reason to avoid enacting such programs, even though proponents may be sued, prosecuted, or held in contempt. Leah, can you talk more about the actions that you're laying out in your Supreme Court chapter?
Yeah, well, we advocate for having race-specific solutions to these issues, and that is because the policies that created them were race-specific in nature and explicitly targeted at African Americans and at excluding African Americans from homeownership opportunities and from being able to access white communities. And so as we solve those problems and create solutions through new policies and strategies, we need to be as race specific in our solutions as the policies that created them were. Now, we understand that the Supreme Court likely won't support this. It believes that we live in a race blind society, but we can't solve these solutions without, addressing how they were created. And so it takes some courage on the part of policymakers and local residents and institutions to create these race-specific solutions, but that's the only way we're going to get out of this. And, you know, that's how civil rights advances have been made. We violate what the current understanding or interpretation of the law is. You know, those who sat in at lunch counters in the South and buses, they were breaking the laws at the time, and then those laws changed. And similarly, more recently, you know, opponents of abortion, when Roe v. Wade was the law of the land, they passed anti-abortion bills in states that supported that until that was overturned by the Supreme Court. So we have an opportunity and an obligation to pursue these race-specific solutions, even though they might be challenged in court. That's how we will make advances on these issues.
Given the Supreme Court is so important, dominated by ultra-conservatives.
Yeah, I'm sorry. You broke up. I couldn't hear you.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry if I broke up. I think I have a connection problem. A rich Supreme Court, given that dominated by ultra-conservatives. Minutes left.
Well, I couldn't hear you either because you were breaking up. But let me say briefly, the Supreme Court has been hypocritical about race, inconsistent about race to a greater extent than I can think of on any other issue. In 1865, we passed the 13th Amendment to the Constitution. It abolished slavery, but it also authorized Congress to enact policies that would abolish what were then called the badges and incidents of slavery. That is, any characteristics of second-class citizenship. In 1866, Congress passed the Civil Rights Act. We think of Civil Rights Acts as being started in the 1950s and 60s. In 1866, Congress passed its first Civil Rights Act, which prohibited any discrimination in the sale and rental of housing, for example. And the Supreme Court prohibited its enforcement. In 1968, 102 years later, the Supreme Court said, whoops, we made a mistake. The 1866 law was perfectly constitutional. There should not have been any discrimination in housing in the intervening 102 years. Well, the Supreme Court acknowledged that mistake, but its conclusion was, let's bygones be bygones, and provided no avenue forward to undo the consequences of what it acknowledged were unconstitutional and unlawful policies for 102 years. That's outrageous. And we need to be much more skeptical of the authority of the Supreme Court when it comes to racial equality than we have been.
Sorry, we're out of time, and I'm sorry about my internet connection. Something's going on with my connection here. Sorry if you heard me and then I went in and out. We'd like to thank Richard Rothstein and Leah Rothstein for joining us today. You can find out more about their new book, Just Action, How to Challenge Segregation Enacted Under the Color of Law, at yourcallradio.org. Richard and Leah, thank you so much for joining us, and I'm sorry about these technical issues. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.